All right, boys. You know, we ain't really in it now. We're in this trench and we've been here for too long. We gotta get out of the, we gotta get over the ladder. We gotta go out into the field.
I can't do
it. We're gonna take those Germans. We're gonna take the Germans. We're gonna take them.
Germans? Ready? What are you talking about, Germans? I thought this was the Prussian one.
What? No, wait. Maybe it's the Hessians.
That's heretics. That's heretics out there.
Wait, what? No.
What are you talking about, heretics?
I think it's Japanese.
No,
you guys are entirely mental. We are in a 1903 scenario.
1903? I thought this was 1943.
I just ordered a drop pod of Terminators for the Emperor!
Alright, look, now I'm not going to have to deal with this kind of, like, insubstantial, like, historical nonsense. We're dealing with 1913. That's what we're going to be doing.
It's
what?
The year 40,000.
I don't agree with this.
No,
we can't do that. No, it's not going to happen. I already brought my things.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to Game Store Profits, where we're here to talk about God, gaming, and groups. And apparently, I am the loneliest musketeer, your host, Jeff Romo, and I am joined by the primariest chaplain, Daniel Fisher.
Hoddly ho, neighbors.
And the proudest member of the 21st Northumberland Fusiliers, T.R. Knight.
Banzai! Totally historically inaccurate.
Completely inaccurate.
And culturally inappropriate in many ways, but just...
Yeah, right.
But that's kind of what we're talking about today.
Yeah, that's kind of the point here. We're going to be going into the whole historical accuracy in games. I mean, there's been some foo-foo-rah lately. You know, we were going to touch on it a little bit with last episode, and I don't think we really got around to it. But I think this episode we're going to grab it by the horns and deal with this rampaging bull. That's not culturally inappropriate.
No, it's an angry red monkey.
We want to stick with the pattern, the format. Having a segment that we can actually tried and true depend on every episode is the cornerstone of any good podcast. I'm going to say that, and then I'm going to talk about the Archive Dive. I have not been playing games.
You know what? I didn't play anything old. I played Dice Thrones, and I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah. But we can depend on our erstwhile wise one.
The old one.
Are you calling me old again?
Your newest game is older than my youngest kid.
Okay, that's true. Okay, so I like older games. I can't help it. Okay, so a little story for mine. So this, we'll give you a fun story for an older game. It's cool. A game that... on these social webs, these social networks, is sometimes lampooned, which saddens my wife and I. And it's the series of games called Flux by Looney Labs.
Oh, yeah.
F-L-U-X-X, for those of you looking for it. Specifically, the one I played this past week was EcoFlux, which actually is no longer in print. It's been renamed Nature Flux. Flux has an interesting story for me. So it's an older game, came out in 1997, which is the year I got it.
I remember buying it the day it came out, not really the day, the year it came out.
If you had known me earlier, I still have some problems, but I used to be highly competitive.
No.
Yeah, I had to mature out of that, to be honest. And I admit it, I'm still competitive at times, but it was bad, and it was very bad, and it was causing to the point that my wife and I did not enjoy playing games together. So, went down to a game store nearby that I trusted. It's called the Game Preserve down in Indianapolis. They're still down there. And I walk into the store, and I walk right up to the guy and say, here it is. I need a game I can play with my wife. And we're not working well, and we're competing. And before I could even finish the sentence, he's like, you want Flux? It's right over here. And I'm like, what? I've never heard of this game. He goes, trust me, it's a new game. You want to play this. It'll be great. It'll work well with you as a couple. It's a fast game. And from what I'm hearing, it's what you need. And I'm like, okay.
So he's not just a game proprietor, he's also a
marriage counselor.
This is pretty cool. I like that.
So I took it home, and to be honest, it's been a hit since. We have Flux, Eco Flux, Monty Python Flux, Firefly Flux, Batman Flux, Holiday Flux, what else? Space Flux. And what it is about Flux that I love is it's got competition, it's got a game, but it is so random. You can have the best strategy going, and one card plays, you're like, yep, I'm starting over. And there are cards we hate. Like, my wife hates the hand limit zero card. There are interesting tactics. And the great thing is it's small, it's portable, it's funny. It goes with us on so many trips. My kids have enjoyed playing it. We've taught tons of people because it's a really simple game at first. Draw one card, play one card, and everything else is what's on the cards. It's the rules are on the cards.
You know, I might have to go back to that because one of my favorite games is we didn't play test this at all.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't get my wife to play it at all.
Yeah.
It's too random for her.
Well, I tell people, it's like, Flux, I've never, at least I have not bumped into somebody who really disliked it when they played it. They may get frustrated by it and other things, but it's just such a simple game. And the thematic ones, like the Batman Flux and the Firefly Flux, are hilarious. I mean, they do such a great job of pulling in the mood. We just got our newest ones. We just got our Chemistry Flux, which my daughter, who wants to be a chemistry teacher, absolutely loves.
Nope, sounds too smart. I'll leave.
Yeah, we also picked up Doctor Who Flux recently, which is fun. So it's interesting because it's an older game. It's been around since 97, but there are new versions coming out constantly. So I highly recommend it. It's a fun game to me. My wife enjoys it. It travels with us a lot. We'll just grab one to play. It's weird to think that it is from 97. That game is much older than I realize, and I've had it since it came out.
You know, that's kind of cool. I'm actually, the more you mention it, I'm wondering if this would be a good one for me to take on my my trip overseas. I've got a missions trip coming up in April, and you know, it may not be necessarily a game that I can play on site with the groups that we're going to be visiting, just because I have to be kind of conscious of, you know, depictions of, you know, people, that right. sort of thing on cards. But it might be kind of like a cool thing for the team, you know, like whether it's on the flight or you know, whether it's, you know, when we're at the compound where we're staying, that sort of thing. So, I mean, it's portable, like you said. Yeah.
The pros and cons I'd give. The pro, it is highly portable, easy to learn. I mean, I've played it in airports, I've played it on trains, I've played it in a car, I played it in a hotel. I mean, it's easy. The con, and it is a big one, you're talking travel, it is very English dependent. There are a lot of words. It gets some kind of, cards will conflict with each other. And so if English is not your native language, so like good example, when I've gone my mission trips, when I've gone over to ICCM in Europe and stuff like that, I don't bring Flux. Because if you have a mixed group that English is not their native tongue, it's not necessarily the best. But it's a fun game. I mean, I do enjoy it. It gets pulled out all the time. I've got a very beat up copy that travels with us everywhere.
Mm.
So there's my archive dive for us, Flux from Looney Labs.
Well, this actually is a good segue into what our topic's about, which is, you know, talking about how games can impact or be impacted or influenced or steer clear of, you know, historical accuracy, cultural accuracy, that sort of thing. Being able to take a game like Flux overseas, it's a good point to kind of remember, okay, some of these jokes may not or connections may not be really good in other languages just because it doesn't make any sense or
right.
it doesn't translate.
Yeah.
But there's also the sometimes game designers are looking to try and bring in cultures into their games, right?
Yep.
And I think we mentioned at the very beginning, Rising Sun is an interesting example of this, Daniel's already laughing, where we're seeing mythology being brought into play, right? So who has a good summary? I don't know, Daniel, you're laughing. Maybe I should make you explain it. But what's the summary of the mythology in Rising Sun?
So got monsters from, it's feudal Japan. It looks like they did pull in some Chinese as well. So as they were pulling in monsters, it appears that the designers of games at Colmini or not really enjoy Wikipedia. So they started looking for other creatures in mythology based in this culture, which, you know, I use Wikipedia to settle arguments all the time because I edit it. So the they came across this creature called Kotai. Kotahi. And it was this enraged monkey god. So, you know, they designed a miniature around it and a story behind it, and they put it into the game. So as people are looking at all these characters and stuff, especially when the game started shipping, which was last month. I still haven't got mine yet. Hopefully I'll have it by the time this is released. Somebody in Japan, that area down there, was like, you know, I've never heard of this creature before. And everybody started researching it and trying to figure out what happened.
Where did they get this?
So there was a guy in New Zealand who his buddy thought was funny. This was his nickname, or his name. I can't remember exactly.
Here we go offending other people. It's not a nickname. It's my real name.
Yeah, I think it is his real name as well. So it's something. It's Molly, I believe it's what it is, because it's the native tongue of New Zealand, or native Aborigines of New Zealand. It's one of their words, and Maori. His friend thought it would be funny in putting a creature in there, a angry monkey god type deal, and cool man or not, pulled it and didn't realize it was not real mythology and created a character for it in Rising Sun.
Now, just to kind of ask the question here, and one of you guys may know more than me, most likely you do, is... Did Cool Mini or Not set out to make, you know, obviously it's a fantasy game. It's not, you know, hey, this is reality. But is it supposed to have been based in concrete mythology? Was that how they built it?
I mean, you got Godzilla in it. I mean,
yeah,
okay.
It's not really.
Here's the thing. It's like we talk about. It's caused a lot of hubbub, and this is one reason we're talking about this. It's all over the social webs. This and a couple other games recently. There's that fine line between, and we're going to talk about this. When does something need to be accurate, like historically accurate? So are we talking simulation? Are we talking gaming? When does something need to be culturally sensitive, whether it be religion or the culture? And so you have to look at that. Like you said, Rising Sun is a board game.
Right.
Rising Sun.
It's a diplomacy game.
It's a diplomacy game. It's a dudes on a map game. So it's a bunch of miniatures. And really the purpose of it was they took mythology as their basis to determine the artwork and the look of the game. But it was not meant to be a educational game. It was not meant to teach you Japanese mythology. It was not meant to accurately depict an era during Japan's history. And so I think it's interesting to see all these people upset about the inaccuracy of this when two things about it. One, it's a Kickstarter exclusive. So the base game does not have this piece. It came out as part of the Kickstarter.
And I hope mine has it.
Yeah. And then...
I want the inaccuracy.
And then the other thing about it is...
It's worth more.
Again, it's a game. And so it looks cool. It's a really neat looking mini. It has an interesting name. It's not quite Japanese name. But my thing is, if you don't want it in your game, the game doesn't have to have it in it. So you can pull yours out of the game and set it aside. So, but it's been interesting to watch. And I think, to me, and this is what I want us to talk about this some today, is... how we get upset about a game being inaccurate. You know, we're all upset. All these conversations are about, well, this is so inaccurate. Didn't they do their research? Didn't they dig into other sources? And I'm thinking, if this was a novel, if this was a research paper, even if this was maybe a role-playing game about Japanese history, that's different than a board game you're going to play for a few hours that's a bunch of mythological creatures fighting each other for dominance.
And especially if at the onset they don't have a blurb at the beginning, you know, a splash blurb that says, based on the historical accuracy of Japanese and Chinese mythology brought together for a board game experience unlike anything else. You know, I mean, it's like, that's not what they really did.
And it was a spiritual successor to Blood Rage. And Blood Rage is not the most accurate Viking game that was ever created.
Really?
Yeah.
Really, TR?
I mean, and this comes from the same company that makes Zombicide. So
that's historically accurate.
Yeah, because the Black Plague, they talked about it in the Green Horde. I mean, seriously, it's right there.
Yeah. I mean, if I'm doing history, I am totally playing Zombicide because that is the most historically accurate game on the market.
I'm thinking.
This is how the Black Plague traveled across the Europe, kids. It was through zombies.
We can look at it from a cultural standpoint. We can look at it from a historical standpoint. And then we can kind of delineate into other more niche things like religion and fictional depictions, that sort of thing. But from a cultural standpoint, I mean, there's so many different cultures to pick from, right? And there's so many different games that strive to kind of bring in some of that stuff. I think from my perspective, I see it more often than not in role-playing games because they're trying to set a scene.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
They have a particular scene or location or time period that they're looking to evoke when you're playing the game. From Victoriana, which admittedly is steampunk, but is set hardcore during Victorian times.
Right, but we have to realize, though, in these games that we play, because they are games, and we build this a lot on our childhood and the things that we've watched everything's a trope. It needs to be taken as a trope on some of these things, like Victoriana. If I'm playing Deadlands, it's going to be a trope. It's a spaghetti western. I'm not really going to accurately play Native Americans. I'm playing Indians.
Right. Which that's, you know, which obviously that's not
politically correct. At the time, no, it's not.
Contextually, yeah. I guess, yeah. During the time, sure, you're going to have that kind of slang and everything.
Well, and it's interesting, too, when we look at this, you know, certain things in games, we don't even blink at. If you have Vikings, pirates, ninjas, we don't even think about it. We look at these games like, okay, it's a Viking game. That's totally cool. Hey, it's a game about ninjas. We don't care.
Wait, are we going to have ninjas on this show?
Yeah, we're going to have ninjas on this. Actually, they're here. You didn't see them?
I'm sorry.
See, a piece of historical information y'all don't know about ninjas. Every culture has ninjas. Japanese are just the worst at it.
That's terrible.
Okay. If you're from Japan or have any kind of relationship.
Well, that's because we know about the Japanese ninjas. Sorry. It's because we know about them. We don't know about the other ones.
But my thing about this is we're so desensitized to those cultures. And yet, when a game comes out that's closer, so we were talking Native Americans, how are they depicted in games? Then you look at other closer cultures. Like when we start looking at games that actually depict the Cold War. So you're looking at how the USSR was compared to the US. What about a game that starts touching even closer things? What about a game that has Amish in it or Muslims in it? What if it's Jewish? I mean, we here on this podcast, we talk a lot about our faith, and we talk about what games have a good biblical background. There's some games we like that way. So it's interesting as you start looking at the culture, like, we don't want to see Christians poorly depicted in a game, but we're okay with Vikings or pirates or ninjas. We're okay. Germans, good example. Almost all World War II games still show Nazis and Germans and Italians as the villains. Yeah.
Right.
If you play Octun Cthulhu, which is Cthulhu based in World War II, if you play any of the World War II board games, you're all going to like Memoir 44. So it's interesting that they're arguing heavily about this game being inaccurate. You know, the idea that this Japanese mythology is inaccurate, but we don't get upset if a war game. Now, true war gamers, the ones that do Napoleonic, Prussian, some of the really heavy reenactors, they're doing what-if scenarios. You know, what if Napoleon had done this? What if Hitler's regime had done this? So I think it's interesting when we talk about cultures and the sensitivity that we don't even have one level that we always balance these in.
Well, we also have to think, though, about the historically accurate war gamers. They don't roll dice.
True.
They go through it and they go, okay, now if Hitler had moved his troops over here or Napoleon had moved his troops over here and attacked this way, they'd be able to flank this and do this right here and they would have been able to decimate this area. But when you add random acts of dicing to it, then that's when you throw it out the window. And that's when it kind of gets in that gray area where this isn't historical anymore. It's fun.
And even culture also, you have to look at temporally.
Yeah.
Like, if you pull out some older games and see how things were predicted, like, you use the word engine, which is a thing that was often used in old games, old movies. You look at anything, old Westerns.
Yes.
Some of my love, but a lot of old Westerns, the way Native Americans and Hispanic and Chinese and Irish were depicted was really rough. Watch a modern Western, and they've actually changed the way they do a lot of that. And you see games that way now, too. So there's a big difference between some of the games we played in the 80s. You know, look at some of the 80s board games and 80s role-playing games. Think of Price of Freedom, Twilight 2000, which were both military games, very anti-communism. You know, they were almost propaganda games. You want to also yell Wolverines as you're playing the game.
Yeah.
There's that side of it, right? There's that kind of like radically inappropriate and not proper depictions, inaccurate depictions.
Yep.
And then you have like these, you know, these games that come along that kind of mix historical accuracy with craziness. Immediately when you mention Native Americans, because I'm a nerd and because I watch a lot of TV, my mind goes to two places. Number one, it goes to Shadowrun.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then the second one is it goes to Longmire because, you know, I'm just built that way. And you were mentioning about having better depictions of Native American life, that sort of thing. I thought Longmire was an interesting kind of a view into it. And again, it's, you know, it's all personal preference. But the interesting thing I thought about with Shadowrun is that they bring in a lot of Native American culture. And at first, it seems accurate. It seems like this is how they would behave in the far future. And, you know, if things could happen this way and, you know, some magical ghost dance could reform the world and awaken all of these this magical creatures and stuff, you know, hooray, that's great. And then it kind of starts taking it into, like, far, deep, extrapolated realms where it's not really accurate anymore. So you've got some of these games that have a blend like that that you can get an appreciation for particular cultures. Like again, with using Shadowrun as kind of a melting pot, 2050 Seattle, where they have much of the game kind of spawns from. You're thinking of Japanese culture. They have Chinese culture, Korean culture, Native American, Hispanic, all of these different cultures kind of in this melting pot, and they have interesting takes on them that don't quite border on offensive. Until you get to like interactions between the cultures, and then they introduce jargon and stuff like that that becomes offensive. But that's in the context of the game.
Well, and Daniel said it well earlier. Almost all these are based off tropes and stereotypes.
Right.
That's how we're doing it, is we take something. Well, a good example. We'll talk about having a common base when we play games. Like if we say the word orc, if you say the word elf, there's certain things that we all have, maybe slightly off how we look, but they're similar. Yeah. Same way, you say Viking, most people look at Vikings in the stereotypes. Big, burly, horn helmets, battle axe, you know, that kind of stuff. You say pirate, you instantly think of, you know, but if you actually look at history, piracy was very different. If you look at the Vikings and how they did their conquest, it was very different. Yeah. So what happens is we already have our trope or our stereotype. And then when we make a game of it, it gets like expanded even bigger. And I think that's where cultural sensitivity, it gets when it's out there far enough that we don't think about it because we don't feel like we're offending the Vikings. But when we try to do things that are closer, when you start doing games like, we're going to talk about history a little bit too. You start looking at games like Freedom, the Underground Railroad. You look at Escape from Colditz. You look at Axis and Allies, an older board game. When you start getting into culture that has historical accuracy involved, then that sensitivity gets harder because now you're like, wait a minute, you're starting to gear towards that simulation. You're repeating something. You're doing an alternate version. That gets a lot harder because now you're like, now, wait a minute. If like I'll go a game that I like and you've talked about before in the past, Sola Fide is about the Reformation. And it's a game where you're playing the Catholics or the Protestants. And it's accurate. It's got a lot of history. But the Catholics can win and stop the Reformation. Well, wait a minute.
Heresy.
That's not historically accurate in what happened. So the interesting thing is, but it's an interesting what-if scenario. But now you've got this Catholics and Christians. So I remember when Stronghold was working on this, and I talked to Steven because I'm like, how do we do this without offending two religious groups? And so we talk about it was being historically accurate and saying, here was the history. Here's where it was. You playing the game get to experience that give and take of that history and of those two communities. And that's interesting as you walk through that. How do you do that while being sensitive, while being accurate? Or do you throw accuracy kind of out a little bit to make it more experiential?
When we were talking about discussing this topic, and I wanted to kind of bring in maybe a game or two, you know, one game that came to mind was Colonial Gothic. I know Daniel and I have been wanting to get that to the table for a while.
Yeah.
They have like a whole series of books. Not a lot of people have heard of this game, but there's like a whole series of books that talks about background scenes, locations, particular battles that really brings in the contrast, like the historical accuracy of the time period. But obviously you're entering in, you're injecting Cthulhu-esque gothic magic type stuff in there.
I love the American Revolutionary War period. I do, as I pointed out earlier today, watch a guy, it's a web blog called The Townsends, and they're reenactors during that time period. And he likes to explain the history behind certain things and how soldiers were treated and how farms were managed and things like that. And I enjoy the cult, and I'm really a big stickler on if it's not accurate, why is it a game? But when I know for a fact, okay, well, this has fantasy in it, so therefore, to me, it's not a historical game. It's kind of like an alternate universe type deal. And that doesn't bother me, but if being a wargamer, one of the reasons why I play in the year 40,000 is because I don't know if I could, because it would really mess with me if I was doing Civil War gaming. And
like, what about like something like Axis and Allies or
right? Yeah, and it kind of bothers me a little bit because, yeah, I know it's a game, and the thing with games is it's a tool to get, you know, people interested in the actual history of it. But when we play these games, we need to, in my mind, it would need to be, the stats would be, need to be stacked in the way to where the guys that won. That's my big problem. And that's also when it comes to Christian games like Sola Fide. I don't know if I could play that because I know how the Reformation turned out. I actually thought about it like last week. It's just one of those things. It's just, it's hard for me to get past.
And see, I'm the opposite. I'm a strategist. That's something I love. Yeah. I'm really into strategy. And so for me, I love what if scenarios. I love the idea of taking something that occurred. So not just alternate, not fully alternate history. I like what ifs. So if this minor thing changed, what would that have done?
Yeah, and that's fine if you're talking about it and discussing it, but where, for me, if you're playing it over and over and over, I've seen kids at comic shops get so obsessed with games that that's all they talk about. And even my kids, my son, he likes to pretend that Enderman's real from Minecraft. And, you know, it gets to a point where he starts dreaming about it at night, and he wakes up with a bad dream that Enderman was going to get him. And, you know, that's just the thing that with that, where people just play it and play it and play it and play it and play it, and their mind gets pulled into it a little bit too much. Sorry.
No, and it's different. Like I work with our library. We've been building a game collection for a library. And one of the things we've talked about is the educational capability of gaming. And so for us, some of these historical and cultural games are great for a library board collection. So as you start looking at, you know, you play this game and it helps you at least have a better understanding of that time in history or a better understanding of that culture. So that's one reason we're looking at getting some of these games. Academy Games is known for this. They put out a lot of games that are based on historical events, time periods. They're almost simulation games. I mean, they have they're still games because like Daniel said, they have that random element. So the game can really change. But they're very research-oriented. They love to dig into the history and put out something that when you play it, you're experiencing.
So with games like that, where they're strictly simulationist, and I ask this from a standpoint of not having experience with this, do they have win conditions that are set when, if you land historically accurately within this realm, so, you know, you not necessarily end up with the same number of pieces of artillery that were still surviving after the Battle of the Bulge or whatever, but ultimately the win condition for your team is that you land historically accurately. Are there games like that?
Well, with most war games, I'll say with like 40K, there's different ways you can win. You can completely decimate the other army, but, you know, they introduced the thing in the last few versions of the game where you do have a win condition, where, you know, you need to get to a power cell that was for a knight that had been, the knight had been destroyed, but you need to reclaim the power cell before the Tyranids get to it and use the power cell for something. So you get to it and bring it back, and then that's your win. And so it's scenarios. It's always based around scenarios.
And the historical games do a very similar thing. So, well, if you go old school, so let's go Axis and Allies. If you played the original Axis and Allies, it was, like Daniel talked about, it leaned towards the Allies winning. They were already ahead. They had everything they needed. It's very hard when you played that game to win as the Axis. And the win conditions were actually somewhat simulation. Like, The Allies had certain things they had to do, and they could win the game. The Axis had to do certain things to win the game. They didn't have to devastate each other. If you look at some other games that are out there like that, Escape from Colditz, you have to get your people out of Colditz, which was what happened historically. If you don't, the Germans win. If you look at other games that have come out that way, Freedom the Underground Railroad is not as much that way. It's really helping you experience what it was like to help slaves move from south to north. So it's that experience. So it doesn't have this specific, you're going to do this in history, because it's more of an experiential game. So I'd say when you're talking historical games, as we talk about that side of it, you have an experience. So The Grizzled, it's a great experiential game. It's not accurate. It's just giving you a feeling of what it was like to have camaraderie in a foxhole, okay? Where Memoir 44 is trying to simulate battles, but it's a pure game. So it's a game, you're doing stuff. Axis and Allies was leaning more towards simulation, but go even deeper and you go back to Squad Leader and Advanced Squad Leader. But the purpose of those was to become even more accurate. So those were leaning towards wargaming, just happened to be using cardboard and everything. So you've got that gamut of some games are just, how do you experience what happened then? But then you get games like Sola Fide, The Fog of War by Jeff Engelstein, is you're doing the logistics of warfare. And to win, you have to capture certain major points if you're the Allies or the Axis that would have been doing. It's like the Axis are trying to take England and trying to other stuff. So it's trying to simulate part of the war, but at the same time, it's very game. It is very much a game, not a simulation. I'm teaching my class again. So today was my lecture on what is a game for game studies. And we got into this discussion on what is a sport, what is a game, what is a simulation, and what is a puzzle, and they're different. And we talked about a true simulation isn't random. It's trying to simulate an accurate event as close as it can. That's the purpose. Now, simulations can simulate beyond what they're depicting to show you other ideas, where a game has a lot of random, it's got choices by people, everything else. And we talked about that. And so I think that's when you look at these games, like I'm not playing Memoir 44 to feel like I'm simulating World War II.
Right.
That's not why I'm playing it. I'm not playing The Grizzled to feel like I'm simulating a war, but I'm playing it to experience the camaraderie, the tension, what it is to emotionally do that. But it's still, it's not me in an actual foxhole. It's not simulating that. It's like the difference when you play video games too. You play a video game that's, well, let's look at some. Red Dead Redemption is not a simulation of the American West.
No, but it's a giving game. You the thing with video games to me, it's like, you know, and I played World War II video games, you know, Medal of Honor.
Yep.
And those, I love those. But the thing is though, it's more on the lines of, I'm not trying to do any historical battles here. I'm trying to see what it was to, like, shoot those weapons at people and kill them type deal. And I did have a goal in mind, kill the other people. And that's, you know, that's what I did. And so, and that's how I played it. But yet, you know, that didn't bother me. It's just when you get into wargaming on the level that I've seen and, you know, where I do the miniature painting and stuff like that.
Well, and that's a whole nother level, like what you're saying. That's a level of pure simulationist. Yeah. It's a level of, and I think actually it's twofold. You could actually bring in some of the experiential feelings of those situations, especially like if you're going to go do the reenactments. That's you know, again, that's a whole plane of existence right there, right? And to where you, what the expectation is to move through the historiosity of this. I'm making up words as I go along. Move through the accuracy of this, right? To step through this event, whether it's Gettysburg or the Battle of the Bulge, or, you know, the sailing the ships on the Barbary Coast, you want, trying to be a real pirate, you know, whatever the case is. It's the idea of experiencing the accuracy, right? So I can actually, I see a little bit more of your perspective there, Daniel, when it comes to wanting to get it right, wanting to see it.
if somebody came up to me for a commission and be like, listen, I play bold action, I want a piece of terrain, and bold action, you know, I've got miniatures for that, I've been trying to get into it. And but if somebody came to me and said, I want a Nazi death camp with ovens and everything built for the table, I would just look at them and say, no, get out of my house. And I mean, I could never do that. I mean, and there's some people out there that will build that terrain, yeah. And I wouldn't do it. Sorry, guys. You just me throwing my hands up in the air, even though it right. is accurate, you know, that is in there, but it's that's now, culturally
insensitive. You bring up an interesting thing, cultural insensitivity. I'm going to try not to make up any more words. I will thank you.
Very doobly of
the, you. I mentioned the game earlier, Victoriana. We've played this role-playing game for Inroads Plays. Go and visit it now. Well, not right now. Finish this episode and then go watch it. But it has at the very beginning of this book, Cubicle 7's really good about saying, look, we understand the world we live in right now. But you need to understand that this is set in a world that was different, that had different views of women, it had different views of other races, it had different views of social castes. And this game is built in mind with having rules to reinforce that social norm. And what I really enjoyed about that is that it addresses that cultural sensitivity. And in fact, it was such a well-done thing. We made it a part of the show. At the very beginning, the first episode, we have a disclaimer saying, look, some of this stuff is not going to come off as really great. We're not going to intentionally throw this out into the forefront, but it may come up in social interactions as part of this simulation. The idea is, like, you know, for instance, like for some of the books they have in this, they have a book called The Smoke, which goes down into minute detail of neighborhoods in Victorian time London. But then they have the whole sections of the main core book that's dealing with how lower classes were treated and how they were held down and how different neighborhoods had to address or how you address that in different neighborhoods. So there's ways for games to address, to bring in cultural interactions, cultural sensitivities, while at the same time keeping pure the historical accuracy. They can take the time to do that. Do you guys find that there are certain games out there, like your Solafitas or whether it's Escape from Colditz or any of these other games that you've mentioned, that they go out of their way to say, look, this is a time frame. This is a time in space where things were different. Keep that in mind when you play this game.
Some games do. Solafide does. It talks about it's a historical event. You know, this was what was happening, and it gives you like the history of each card, which was unique. Like every card in the game, it explains where they got it from. What was the purpose? What was the history of that event, that book, that tome, that person, whatever it was. So you see some of those, and I think that gets you, that's again, that is the game more gamey? Is the game more simulation? So your games that are really just experiential and fun and just happen to be about a topic, they really don't care about explaining. Like Blood Rage does not have anything in there that talks about Scandinavian, you know. But I have a Viking game that's called Fire and Axe. Fire and Axe is much more about going out, fishing, doing mining, plundering cities occasionally. But it's much more accurate to what was that time period. So it's not as exciting. It doesn't have as many fun miniatures. But it's a gorgeous game. It is fun to play. And it does touch more on what it is to have been a Viking in that time period. So I think we're kind of talking in this area. We kind of keep coming back to it. Sensitivity, I think, not only into the game and the accuracy, also comes down to the player. So we've kind of touched on this. Daniel is uncomfortable with certain aspects. He doesn't want to play certain kind of games. He doesn't want to have certain elements in his game. And I'm the same way. There are things that I don't. And so I think culturally, should we have certain things? Are there things that should never be made into a game? Like, I'm going to touch on something very touchy. This is something I have friends who are writers. Is harassment, or even worse, to the point of rape, is that a good storytelling tool? Well, having it as something you read or watch in a story is different than experiencing it in a game. And so you get these topics, like you were talking about, ovens, the Holocaust. Knowing that it happened historically, watching a movie like Schindler's List, or something where it's you're experiencing that history is different than having a game where you have that done. You do that to somebody else.
Right. Well, and that's the thing, though. I've seen D&D games where that's happened. You know, where the DM uses rape as a storyline. But really, when it happens to a character, not an NPC, but like he uses it on a female character in the group.
Yeah.
That's not good, especially if it's being played by a girl. I mean, at any point in time, it's hard to do that right. Yeah. You have to dance around the subject matter so finely just to get the story right. And, you know, we watch TV shows, crime shows, and all these things. That's the subject matter. Yeah. But do you really want your kids playing D&D with you and the DM brings up, well, your character was taken to the back of the blah, 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 and this happened?
Yeah. No. Like I said, and I'm not bringing that up as something that it's the same, but I'm just, when we talk about this whole sensitivity and stuff, you end up getting these interesting fine lines to where certain things we're all willing to just go, I'm okay with it. You know, I'm okay that there's combat in my game. I'm okay that there are Vikings, pirates. I'm okay that there are Chinese, Russians. But then you get to these points where certain things we consider a problem. Like last podcast, we talked a little bit about evil characters in our games. Some of us have problems with that. But then we get this middle area of, are there things that shouldn't be in a game at all? And that's interesting because if there, like I said, should the whole idea of the Nazi things and the Holocaust ever be in a game? Should there be a game about slavery? Should, you know, there's been controversies about that. What game was it? Five Tribes had the issue with having a slave in the game, and they changed it. If you remember that coming out of the controversy. Yeah.
There's layers to, how should I say this? There's points along the creation of a game, the playing of a game, the purchasing of a game, that sort of thing. There's points along the way where certain social agreements can be entered into, certain social contracts can be entered into, right? So like for instance, with Daniel's Correct. Example about, you know, a character being assaulted, you know, there needs to be a social contract at the beginning of that game saying, look, you know, I, the game master, have had an idea for a story for a while, but I need to let my players know that this is going to get dark. You know, this is going to enter into territory you may not be comfortable with. So I need to know ahead of time, is there a line that we don't want to cross, or do we not even want to entertain this? You know, you have that layer of social contract. You were mentioning television shows where I think it was Daniel mentioned television shows that we watch. Again, we as the viewer are entering into a contract to say, I am going to allow the creation of this director and production company to enter into my brain. And then there's the next step, which is game creation. Do we allow creators to kind of bring some levity to this? Do we allow creators to go to Wikipedia to pull historically accurate information, quote unquote, historically accurate information into our games? Do we allow that? And do we fact check it? Do we make sure that it's correct? Or, you know, and then, you know, again, kind of bringing back in a little bit of the darker subject matter, like with Five Tribes, do we go out of our way to create a game that's accurate, knowing that there's some sensitive material here, but we get a social contract with our audience, our potential audience, saying, look, we want to make this game as accurate as possible, but we also want to be sensitive to the material that's involved in this game. And I don't know the situation specifically with Five Tribes, but is there enough leeway in the purchasing public for a company to go out there? And I think, you know, venues like Kickstarter are a great way to test the waters on this, saying, hey, I'd like to do this. Is this something people would like? And then they get feedback and then they say, okay, this might not be good for the general population.
Yeah, I've seen some of the craziest things kickstarted that I would never
have absolutely. Thought would and make it. Yeah, absolutely. We even talked about in the pre-show about a few games that we could probably rattle off and say that there's no way I'd even get near the website.
I would say there's enough weirdos out there to do
anything. but there's going to be people who are going to enter into that contract head first and say, I can't wait to dive into that.
Yeah.
So I don't know, maybe this might be an opportunity to make the turn, as it were. talking about social contracts, right? Talking about how we view games. You know, we have some varying perspectives, I think, on, you know, historical games, cultural accuracy. I know, Daniel, you had a really good opinion, I think, on wanting to make sure that we get it right. You know, right. If we're going to enter into a contract on a game, that we want to get it right. With TR, you were looking at the fluidity of being able to play a near simulationist game, but having the leeway to say, you know what, things could happen a little bit differently.
Correct.
You know, for me, I cite games like, oddly enough, Shadowrun, not for its cultural authenticity, but for the effort that the creators put into trying to bring in some authenticity to the game. And then realizing, hey, we're talking about the year 2050 and BTL chips and all this other nonsense. You know, so there's got to be a little bit of tongue-in-cheek with it.
Wetware and dragons.
And dragons, exactly, for running for president. Dunkel's on 2016. TR, you brought up a really great verse here from Romans 12:16, and it reads, live in harmony with one another. Do not be haughty, but associate with the lowly. And never be wise in your own sight. The reason I picked this, because you had two or three verses that I thought were really good, and I picked this one purposefully. I highlighted it in our show notes as we're all looking at it at the same time, because the word that kept rolling over in my head was sensitivity. It's being sensitive, not just to the creators of the games, but the creators of the games being sensitive to the subject matter that they introduce into their game, and then us as players and as consumers being sensitive to our fellow players, being sensitive to the people who create these games. Are we I will hazard a guess, and Daniel, you can back me up on this, but you'll come across some very quote-unquote haughty people in the arena of the 40K game world.
You come across them in any genre,
and yes, and it descends into many genres. Anything from, gosh, this is completely randomly popped into my head, the new Solo preview, the Star Wars preview, and how I'm seeing like rants and raves about how the Millennium Falcon doesn't look the same. And somebody I saw posted an entire string saying that the YT-1300 was meant to be a freighter ship and it has to have those two prongs on the front because that's where it picks up the stinking cargo. So people are just ranting left and right about it. And it's accuracy, right? It comes down to accuracy.
Right, and I mean, they'll argue over that.
Yeah.
Well, and I think the thing we talked about too, when we're talking about the sensitivity and everything, I think it comes down ultimately for a lot of this, and the scripture talks about it well, is, and you talked about it having that social contract, it comes down to who we play our games with.
Yeah.
We have to make sure, and another scripture I talked about is the whole weaker brother concept. If I'm going to play games with people, whether it is role-playing, board games, card games, even what movies I watch, TV I watch, I have to be doing it in harmony with the people I'm with. I have to be having a game that we all feel comfortable to play. So, like, there are games out there I don't want to play, and I'm not going to bring them to the table. I'm not going to offer them. There's characters that we talked about. I don't want evil characters in my role-playing games. I don't want culturally insensitive characters. My daughter is now big into role-playing, and she actually has to tell her players ahead of time that she's playing a very egalitarian game. So she's a female dungeon master, so she has women in every role in her world. She doesn't have what a lot of us have grown up with. So she has female knights, female lords, and all this, and it's wonderful to watch. But she actually had a player. They were playing Cogs, Cakes, and Swordsticks, which is a steampunk-style game. And someone was talking about, well, that woman would just faint, you know, from all this. And she had to kind of, she goes, I'm sorry, you're fine, but let me talk about how this works. And it's interesting because that's a different context. That's her context in gaming. And she's had to tell her players that she is a female storyteller, tells her stories different than her father has told stories over time. And even my stories, having now gamed with her, I've completely changed even how I view things in life, in my perspective. Like, we didn't get into diversity or inclusivity, and that wasn't the discussion for today. But we're talking about harmony, and I think when we talk about that harmony, we have to keep it, in fact, not only just who we're playing with. So we're at a convention, it's who's around the table with us. You know, who may walk by. Are we in a family-oriented thing, like at a church game night? You know, there are games that I don't bring to church game nights. because I don't think they would be appropriate for someone to play in an open setting like that. I'm okay personally playing the game with my game group, but I'm not going to bring it to a church game night or a community game night. And so I think that's sort of what we look at here is when we're talking about not being haughty and never be wise in our own sight, we have to be thinking of others when we play games. And if we're going to design games or write our own campaigns, we have to be thinking of the others who will play that game.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. That's an excellent point because we can bring a game to the table. Like, let's say, for instance, I bring in Shen Warring States, which is like a Chinese fantasy role-playing game. You know, if you sit down with Chinese people who are very deep into their culture, you know, is your concern that, you know, are we being sensitive to them? Am I making sure that I'm playing a game that's going to speak to them? You don't want to get into a mode of tap dancing or walking on eggshells, but you want to get into a mode of being respectful. Never be kind of what Roman says here, never be wise in your own sight. You know, allow yourself to say, okay, I may not know everything about this, but maybe somebody else around the table may know more, and right. Allow for that.
Well, I think that we have to judge by what type of game it is. You know, for example, Rising Sun did get it wrong, okay? But it's not a historically based game. It's a diplomacy. It's not like the point of the game is genocide to a certain people group. And I know some people would play that if a game like that came out. And I'm not saying I would never do that. But, you know, that's when you start looking at it, you know, We make fun of our own cultures from time to time, and we poke fun at it, and you know that it happens, and so, you know, we do give ourselves a little leeway on our own stuff, and I'm pretty sure other cultures do as well, but it's just when you start crossing that line, and I don't think that we have to worry too much about that. I think, you know, when it comes to stuff like that, but make-believe things, I think it's kind of hard for them to, they're genociding a whole race of elves. Yeah, I don't think that, yeah. That would, people would actually buy that, but, yeah. You know, if we were saying that the game was genocide to a whole group of people like the Chinese, you know, that wouldn't fly. Becomes,
it becomes a little too close to reality.
Yeah.
Well, and I think you talked about it well when we talked about that sensitivity. The culture also has to be, as gaming becomes more open, if you travel internationally, if you play with people who have traveled in, not only do we have to look at how we view culture, you have to do how do they view it. And so I think what we're doing tonight is a big part of this. We have to be willing to have these conversations. Don't use your own wisdom. If you're not sure, ask your gaming group, are you comfortable with this game? You know, not even a social contract, just that normal question. Or if you know you're going to be in another area, ask people. Like before I've gone to Europe, I've asked some of my friends that have lived over there, should I bring this game with me? You know, is this game something that would be good where I'm going? And I think that's that whole of not being wise in your own sight. Us having this conversation tonight was a great conversation. It wasn't a rant. We were actually thinking through it. We were challenging each other. We're working through it. And I think that's what we need to do more of is have these open dialogues to talk about, is this game okay? If it's, you know, is this game something I'm comfortable playing, you're comfortable playing? If one of us is not comfortable playing it, then we shouldn't. You know, that game should be set aside for other things. So I think, to me, it's that being open to dialogue is one of the greatest ways to gain wisdom, is to listen to other people.
And it comes down to asking yourself the question, will this game flux?
So true. It's. I'm not sure if I'm going to be able to handle the randomness of that comment.
Well, I think we have come to a point where we can agree to disagree, but more importantly, we can agree to talk about it, which is an immensely important. It's very important.
It is very important. But you know, always remember, God is the game master, and no matter how the dice fall, the game plays on.